I'm John Kroll. Today's No Limits is going to be a scrumptious one. We're going to talk about the Dig In Taste of Indiana Food Festival, which is in its eighth year. We'll talk about the festival in particular and the food scene in Indiana in general. My guests are Chef Tom England, one of the Dig In founders, Ted Grain, who is on the Indy Food Council Advisory Board, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, and you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the 8th annual Dig In Taste of Indiana Festival. If you would like to take part in this tasty conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Chef Tom England, who is one of the Dig In founders, Ted Grain, who is a member of the Indy Food Council Advisory Board and is also with LISC, that's the Local Initiatives Support Corporation, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. Welcome to all of you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So, Tom, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit about what Dig In is.
Okay. Dig In is actually a nonprofit for the promotion of Indiana food, beverage, and agriculture. Most people know it because of the festival that we do the last Sunday in August every year called Taste of Indiana. So, people come out from all over the state and really get to enjoy restaurants that are producing using local foods. We actually go out to the farms and buy the raw products from the farms and deliver them to the restaurants so that the restaurants can make that food up. So people just kind of wander around the park and try all the different great foods that are made here in Indiana.
Where is it? Where's the location?
It's at Military Park this year. So we're actually moving this year. So it's in a new location. And that's from 11 to 4 on August 28th.
Okay. And presuming that people want to attend, where do they go to find information and or buy tickets? Do they need to buy tickets?
Yes. We will sell a lot of tickets before the event. We always do. So the event, the best place to get tickets is at digindiana.org, which is our website. There you'll also be able to find a lot of information about local foods, where to find them, and the importance of local food.
And how much are the tickets?
General admission tickets are only $40. And again, that gets you in the door, and all the tastings are free after that. So you can eat about 6 pounds of food if you manage to taste everything that's in that park.
Ted, how important is this festival to the local food scene?
Well, Dig In has done a great job of promoting the local food scene. I think so we're the 11th state in the union in terms of agricultural production, but we're the 33rd in terms of on the locavore index in terms of local food consumption and production. So I think what we're seeing here is Dig In is filling a gap, a really necessary gap, which is to say that local food could be a bigger economic driver for the state of Indiana.
And Kimberly, talk to me a little bit about how it is, how important this festival is to a local business such as Easley.
Yeah, no problem. Well, I think we've all seen the craft beverage industry in Indiana explode over the past 10 years, and we believe that an educated consumer is going to be a happy consumer. So it's events like these that craft breweries, craft wineries can get out, get people trying our great products, and then find them in their local communities.
How many people, and I'll toss this out, how many people come to Dig In now?
So the Taste of Indiana Festival, we have 4,000 paid attendants at the festival itself. And we try to limit that so that people can get in and don't have to wait in lines forever to try everything.
It can sell out then. You cap how many people attend.
Yeah, 5,000 people will be in attendance that day.
5,000 people will be in. And where do they come from?
Our largest, obviously, is Indianapolis. Our third largest is Chicago, of all places. So we have a lot of people coming down from Chicago. A contingency always comes over from Los Angeles and southern Florida. So, yeah, we've people literally coming in from all over the country. USA Today has ranked us in the top 10 food festivals in the nation several years in a row now. So it has a following outside of Indiana.
What draws people, Ted, would you say, from other parts of the country? As you point out, it sounds like it's one of those features of the state that we Hoosiers don't necessarily appreciate ourselves. The gap you pointed to between we're the 11th highest food producing state, but 33rd in consuming what we produce ourselves. That's a pretty significant disparity.
Well, I think food is special. So, and local food is especially special. And what I mean by that is unique, authentic cuisine. Actually showcases what is unique and authentic about a place. And places are what interest people, and the history and the distinct quality of places can be shown in food. So people are showing up because, in part, this is their heritage. This is where they understand their food comes from. And increasingly, people are seeing food as a thing to be celebrated, and that they're really not as interested anymore in the prepackaged food of our parents, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess where I was going with that is, yeah, I can see the argument for Hoosiers. We'd say this is part of our heritage.
Sure.
But, you know, from what Tom is telling us here, Chef Tom is telling us, is that you got people flying in from Los Angeles. It's not necessarily part of their heritage to eat Hoosier cuisine.
You know, an interesting study that came out last year was from the Department of Tourism, and it said that 84% of people who travel want an authentic food experience when they travel. And so they reach out to those places that are using the local foods and have that local food history in their foods. So, you know, we've seen that increase in local food tourism, and I think that's truly part of this, is people want to come and experience, you know, 50 different restaurants at once. And get a story of 50 different places, as opposed to, you know, trying to make it to five or six restaurants in one weekend.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the 8th annual Dig In Taste of Indiana Food Festival here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Kimberly, what are you going to showcase? What is Easley going to showcase at the festival?
Well, we have a lot of really great products, and I really like what Ted was saying about the heritage that Indiana grape growers have. And so we'll be showcasing some of the products that are grown right here in Indiana and of our southern Indiana grape growers that have adapted over the years. And we develop grapes that grow really well to Indiana's climate. One being the Traminette grape, which is Indiana's state grape, Indiana's state wine. It grows really well here. It's a hybrid of a European and American vintage. And so we'll be highlighting that, as well as some of our wines that you can find that consumers have demanded in the grocery stores. So our line of Reggae wines are incredibly popular, and we just came out with a fourth one, Sangria. So we'll be highlighting that as well, five all-natural fruit juices, as well as some of that grapefruit that we've been discussing.
And what kind of experience do you hope that the people who come to taste your wines will have at Dig In?
I hope they get an educational experience, but also kind of find that one wine that they love. There's so many different types, so many different varietals grown here, like I was saying with the Traminette, but also Chamberson, which has been grown for hundreds of years, and a lot of people aren't familiar with that grape, as well as wines like Chardonnay and some of these that grow really well in our climate. And so not only for the consumer to come and try those different things, or even try beers that they haven't tried before, that way they can say, you know, I love IPAs, I love Chardonnays, I love Traminettes, and they can take that back to their community where they shop and the restaurants that they go to.
We've gotten a question from a listener via Facebook, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Megan asked the question, I would love to go to Dig In, but is it safe for those with gluten allergies?
Yeah, I've had a couple of questions come up about gluten and also peanut butter allergies. So we, as a festival, don't control that, but each of the restaurants does. And so we just encourage people as they go around the site that they ask the different restaurants, is there, you know, gluten in this, or is there, you know, whatever the allergy may be in each of the products? You know, I can tell you 80% of the restaurants don't use gluten in this case. So most of them are, you know, vegetable based and protein based, because we highlight what is happening here in Indiana. There's not a ton of breads out there, or, you know, flour products. Most of what we're doing is, you know, focusing on that local stuff that's really in season this time of year.
Gotten another question from a listener named Darren via Twitter, and if you'd like to send us a tweet, you can find us at WFYI. Darren says, in their stats, what counts as food for production? And then he adds a comment. Mm. I'm wondering if they are taking out food grown as feed for livestock, et cetera.
So
everyone's looking in your direction, Ted, so
sure,
I think you
sure.
get to ask so the answer that one.
The quote about that we're the 33rd state in terms of the locavore index, that locavore index is just a measure of local food consumption. Mm-hmm. And that's made up of how many farmers markets we have, how many community-supported agricultures, and how many local farms that are serving a local community and not just putting their product into the commodity market. So I don't know the exact answer to that question that the gentleman just raised. To me, I think the important thing from the LISC perspective, from Local Initiative Support Corporation, we're about improving neighborhoods in Indianapolis. And a big part of that is creating job opportunities for people in urban neighborhoods. We did a study in 2014 that was an economic cluster analysis of what are the best clusters of economic activity that suit the urban context. And one of the clusters that emerged, this consultant was out of Boston, called Mass Economics. One of the clusters that emerged was food manufacturing. In other words, food manufacturing fits the urban context, it fits the existing building stock, it fits the workforce that's currently in the neighborhoods in terms of who can get those jobs. And so our intention and hope is to keep growing that food manufacturing and food production sector in the urban areas as well.
Ted, I'm going to stay with you for a second. That 11 to 33 disparity, has that been relatively static, or have we seen movement one way or the other in terms of closing that gap?
I think we've seen a little movement over the last couple years, and I don't have the figures in front of me. I think Dig In actually has done a great job in helping that happen. I don't know if
when we started, actually, we got together as a group and started 9 years ago. And at that time, we were 42nd, and now we're up to 33rd. So,
I
think that's a big
jump.
Nine
spots.
Yeah.
You've jumped nine spots. And what accounted, would you say, for the disparity in the first place? I mean, it's even worse. It sounds like it was 31 spots.
Yeah, no.
Not that long ago.
We as a society are in Indiana are bringing in 92% of what we eat from out of state. And that's the number that I think we need to really focus in on, is how do we shift that number even 2%, which would make, you know, a huge impact on the state. And if we can really just get the people to spend a dollar on local food per week per family, it would make close to $1 million or $1 billion impact with a B on the state.
What are those figures right now? Do we have any idea of how much locally produced food is consumed here in the state?
So out of the in Indiana, $16 billion a year, more or less, is purchased in terms of food, and about $14.5 billion a year is imported from out of state. So the reality is we are a great state in terms of agricultural production, but we're exporting most of our food in terms of commodities and not eating it here locally.
And Kimberly, how much of Easley's business is in-state as opposed to out-of-state?
Well, we primarily wholesale, and so, but a majority is right here in the state. We distribute to every inch of the state, and I would say that's well over 50% of what we wholesale.
Does your customer base, do they say that one of the reasons they come to you is because they do see that it's important to buy locally?
The people who come to the winery certainly do. Anyone who goes to a craft beverage, you know, whether it be wines, distill, or winery or brewery, it's because they find a passion for that. And I think you see that not only in the younger age group, but also, you're finding that across the board. So, and then now they're demanding it in grocery stores. So that's why you're seeing a lot of the wineries and breweries getting into that other market, because the consumer has demanded it.
Yeah, we have seen a lot of that shift from beer and wine into local foods. And so, you know, the breweries and the wineries are great partners in getting people's minds trained to, oh, this is local. We talk about it with coffee all the time. You know, we know mm-hmm. exactly where it comes from. But, you know, shifting minds to think of where their vegetables come from is a huge thing.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the 8th Annual Dig In Taste of Indiana Festival. My guests are Chef Tom England, one of the Dig In founders, Ted Grain, a member of the Indy Food Council Advisory Board and also with the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the 8th Annual Dig In Taste of Indiana Festival. It's coming up here in about a week and a half. My guests are Chef Tom England, who's one of the Dig In founders, Ted Grain, a member of the Indy Food Council Advisory Board. He's also with LISC, that is Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can do what a listener has done and reach out to us via Twitter. You can find us at WFYI. Listener's tweet says, I heard previously the Dig Indiana Festival would raise money for a food and grower grant program. Is that still the case, Tom?
Repeat that again?
Says, I heard previously that Dig Indiana Festival would raise money for a food and grower grant program. Is that still the case?
We do a lot of connecting as a nonprofit organization. We're a nonprofit that's out there every day of the year and connecting farmers and chefs and helping people to develop food programs. We encourage people to apply for grants through the Food Council, is through SARE grants, through the USDA, many other programs. So, we help them find those grants for sure.
Where do the funds from Dig In go?
That's a great question. So most people don't realize the Taste of Indiana is a losing festival. We make no money on that festival at all.
Hence the not-for-profit.
It's a nonprofit.
We take that very seriously.
Absolutely. Because we pay for all the food that's served, because we pay for all the beer and the wine that's served in the park, that event cost us close to $250,000 to promote local food. So, we're looking for donations to help to do some of those grant works. But at this point, it is not a money-making effort.
So, by my math, if you say you got 5,000 people coming at $40 a head, that's $200,000 and leaves you $50,000 short.
Right, exactly.
Okay. We also have an email from our regular listener, Marion. And if you want to join the conversation by email, you can send your email or your question to nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion wants to know if there are going to be vegan options there. And Marion also has an ongoing concern about CAFOs confined.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wanted to know. I'm simplifying your question here, Marion, in the interest of brevity, what role CAFOs might play.
So Dig In is an organization for promotion of Indiana food, beverage, and agriculture. And as part of that, we try to bring everybody to the table. It's hard to answer that question because almost every board member is very much about small, sustainable agriculture. We do, in some cases, have restaurants that prefer to bring in the animals that they're using on a normal basis, which may come from a CAFO. when we set up so that the restaurants can be participants, they actually go online and sign up, and they have to pick what protein or what vegetable they're going to be serving at the festival, so that we spread it out so that we don't have 200 or 50 restaurants doing pork belly. So we limit what is in the park and make it so there's more diversity. Of the 50, 10% are vegetarian based, and 3 have to be vegan. There are more that are vegan, but 3 have to be vegan. So there's a large variety in the park for sure. It's not all just meat fest.
Walk me through how Dig In came to be, how we got here.
Sure. So the Indianapolis Museum of Art was having a year-long series on local food and school, so more of the farm-to-school efforts that were going on, which was, you know, a new thought back then, and obviously a very important conversation to have. So each month we were getting together as restaurateurs and chefs, as well as local councilmen and even state representatives, and talking about, you know, how do we bring more food into the schools from local regions. And that was capped off by a program with Alice Waters, who is a well-known restaurateur in Berkeley, California, who really started the local foods movement in 1972. So myself and Neil Branham and Regina Mihalik were at lunch with her, Alice Waters, and she made the comment, you know, why don't you take more effort as individuals in getting that information out there about local food, and you know, why aren't you doing a Taste of Indiana festival? And so Neil and I walked out of that lunch and said, okay, let's do this. And by the end of the night, we had a plan going. So it just kind of grew from there.
Out of curiosity, where was the lunch where you had this discussion?
You know, that's when PUX was still at the IMA. Okay. And so we were in a PUX. But, you know, that was the first thing that was asked is, you know, what's being served that was local. And even back then, the wait staff kind of stuttered a little bit. So we had some great maple leaf duck, I think, at that point.
Well, and Ted, this whole local foods initiative and really the shop local movement has exploded in the way, you know, relatively few movements do over the past 10 to 15 years. What do you think accounts for that? I mean, because you're obviously intimately involved. Why has it resonated as powerfully as it has?
I think it's an answer to the question of what makes a place special. Why do we want to live somewhere? Why do we want to invest our time and money in a place? And I think food is a big part of that. I've seen it be part of a trend towards reinvesting in our city, in the urban neighborhoods that are in our city, in the historic fabric of our city. I see it part of that trend. So LISC works with communities to improve their neighborhoods. And primarily, we work in the urban core of Indianapolis. And we're seeing an increased attraction and excitement about these neighborhoods that really have these great bones, these wonderful places to be, and food is a huge part of that. So I think it's a trend towards the authentic, a trend towards this authentic experience of living.
You know, I think food is a common language that everybody talks, and so, you know, talking about building neighborhoods, I 10 years ago I was going to the farmer's market and might see the same 50 people every week. Now you go to the Broad Ripple Market and it's, you know, hundreds of people and, you know, you're meeting people that you've never seen before, but yet you have this common language over a, you know, a tomato and all of a sudden I know my neighbors and we care about people we know about. And so, you know, it just really builds a community around food. And I think that's really important to, you know, stop and talk to your neighbor who's growing those vegetables on the porch and, you know, spend time out knowing who your neighbor is.
Kimberly, how long has Easley Winery been in business?
We've been in business for 42 years. We are an urban winery, which is unique to the industry, and we're actually rated top 10 by Yahoo Travel in the past few years. So, but we've been in our location at College in Ohio for well over 40 years.
Well, that was sort of a setup then to the following question, because in some ways that history envelops the development of the local food movement and this focus on it. How has the rise of this consuming local, you know, not just food, but beverages and all of that, changed the way that Easley has to do business?
Certainly.
What new opportunities has it created? What new challenges does it present?
Yeah, well, when Jack and Joan Easley, who, you know, actually helped legalize the industry back in the 70s, started it, they wanted that location that people can go to. And back then, you know, especially the East Side, Near East Side, was developing in this urban landscape. And over the years, they, you know, you have this agricultural business. We had our farms down in southern Indiana, and so that's over the years they saw that it really was two different businesses to have the winery and the agricultural side. So they found these long-term partners that they could rely on. And so over the course of 40 years, moved to, you know, creating these great beverages that you've seen, you know, with beer and distilleries as well. They kind of have the same model, and then a location to buy this great fruit. So, and then now to today, with what we're talking about, that the growing number of people who want to find it in their communities. And I think on the beverage side of things, not only do they want to feel that community at their local craft brewery or winery, but they also want diversity. Because they don't, you know, we all know the big brands, but I think our generation and the people who live in Hoosiers, they want diversity. They don't want to go to the restaurant, the grocery store, and see the exact same kind of light beers or, you know, your traditional Chardonnays. They want to try different things at every single event that they go to. So, and we've reflected that in what we've been able to offer over the years.
Ted.
I think it's a great example that Easley brings, because right where you're located, just south of there, then Sun King opens up, mm-hmm. right? And then if you take that Mass Ave corridor, kind of that Near East Side mm-hmm. development, take it up to 10th Street, and there's the Circle City Industrial Complex building. Mile Square Coffee is now located in there. You got a new brewery in there. New Day Meaderies production is in there. And you take that Mass Ave corridor further out. When we did the study I referenced earlier in terms of the cluster analysis and food manufacturing, we saw that along Mass Ave, and particularly as you head towards the northern part of Mass Ave, 10th and towards Sherman, that was really almost a food district. There's so many different food manufacturing things happening there that it's really exciting. I think one way forward for the city of Indianapolis and for that neighborhood would be to really double down on that food activity yeah. there and focus on it in a way that we could really incentivize it, catalyze it, synergize it, and make it even more powerful in terms of economic activity, but particularly jobs for the people around that neighborhood.
We keep calling it the fermentation corridor, so all of right. those breweries and wineries through there. And you see things like the Smoking Goose opening up across the street from Flat 12 in the same neighborhood. So, you know, those complementary businesses that go right along with it. So, yeah, it's just this whole food culture that is really developed through that area.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about, well, really food but and beverage. But the springboard for the conversation is the upcoming 8th Annual Dig In Taste of Indiana Food Festival. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Larry has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
What's a CAFO? I heard you use the word CAFO.
Oh, okay. It's actually an acronym. So, I'll let Tom take it. Thank you. Thanks
sure.
very much for the call, Larry.
So CAFO is Confined Animal Feeding Operation is what it stands for. And, you know, it's just your average commercial farm at this point that raises animals. Typically, one barn for pigs would be 40,000 pigs, so four quadrants of 10,000 pigs. And it's just the modern form farm system.
And why? I'll anticipate Larry's next question, which is, why is that a source of concern?
Yeah, so some people
or
are
debate, I should
right.
say.
Some people are very concerned about the fecal matter, mainly, in raising so many animals in a confined space, because of the mass consumption of different feeds, it can produce different bacteria in the fecal matter. And the question becomes, how do you safely dispose of that fecal matter? Commonly, the farmer will go out and test the fields to see where nitrogen levels are and all the chemical levels and compare that to the pit of fecal matter and then spray it on the fields in the correct proportion so that it absorbs into the fields.
And I should say, so that our regular listener, Marion, does not have to send us yet another email. There are also our, and I want to make it clear to Marion that we have heard her. We listen. We listen to our audience as well as asking them to listen to us. Marion would advance a moral argument as well and say that that's just not the right way to treat living creatures.
Right.
That is the other concern that is out there. So let's talk a little bit about the festival. What am I going to see there if I go?
Sure. So again, you know, one ticket gets you in the gate, and then we'll have 45 different restaurants there, each restaurant producing different foods so that you can go around and see what a chef would do with the local foods that are coming from the local farms. You'll also see about 20 different breweries. You'll see wineries from around the state. And, you know, it's just a great time to walk around, take your time over the festival time to enjoy the foods, take little breaks in between in the shade of Military Park. But also we'll have a chef competition going on as well. And so you can go and watch 8 of the best sous chefs from around the state competing for the best sous chef title. Yeah, just a lot of fun little things going on in the park.
So what sort of cuisine? I mean, you say that they've entered. What would I be looking at if I came? What kind
sure.
of options?
I mean, there's everything from really good barbecue and all the way up to, you know, restaurants that are some of the best restaurants, Oakley's Bistro or, you know, the better restaurants from around town. But we do have at least 25% of the restaurants coming from out of the Indianapolis area, too. So, you know, bistros from Portage, Indiana and Pendleton and other places from around the state, Mishawaka, Evansville, Fort Wayne. And that's a good opportunity for people from in the metropolitan area to go out and try some food that they may not normally see. That is just, you know, some of the phenomenal food from around the state that are coming from restaurants that are using local food.
Kimberly, when Easley is at Dig In at the Taste of Indiana Food Festival, do you offer the entire palette of Easley's wines, or are there some that you select? And if you select them, why do you select them?
Sure. We don't. We offer anywhere from 20 to 24 different wines at our location downtown. And so when we go to these festivals across the state, we kind of have to choose not only what's available in their market, but what reflects the sort of spirit of that festival. So Dig In, like I said, you know, talking about our Traminette and some of the wines that contain these local products. So they're special to Indiana would be the spirit of the festival. And you'll see that with a lot of the wineries and breweries.
How many of them are you going to offer?
Dig In actually only allows 2 wines from each winery.
They're very unique in that, but yeah.
And a couple of reasons for that. We want them to showcase the best wines for the market, but we also don't want people to leave totally smashed. So when you have so many different wineries and breweries and you're offering free samples, this gives them an opportunity to taste the best stuff that each brewer and winery has without being problematic with their overconsumption.
Okay, so Kimberly, paint me a word picture of the 2 wines then that Easley's going to offer.
Well, Traminette is, like I said, it's a hybrid and it offers these great like honeysuckle and light citrus flavors, no oak, and it is a white, kind of a semi-sweet, not too dry. We called it a Goldilocks wine, not too sweet, not too dry. And then with our Reggae Sangria, it is a fruit explosion. Like I said, 5 all-natural fruit juices, and really that just paints this magical tropical goodness on your palate.
And, you know, when you say that, Tom, that you're limiting this to 2, what are some of the other experiences that we're going to have there? What are the other wineries or breweries there?
I don't have the details from the different wineries for sure. The breweries, again, just seeing a range of stuff. So each brewery is bringing 1 tap. So each brewery of the 20 will have a different style. So that we can go around as consumers and try the different things that each of the breweries are doing as well.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Dig In Taste of Indiana Food Festival. It's coming up in about a week and a half. This is going to be the 8th annual Dig In Taste of Indiana Food Festival. My guests are Chef Tom England. He is one of the Dig In founders. Ted Grain, who is a member of the Indy Food Council Advisory Board, and is also with LISC, that is the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the 8th Annual Dig-In Taste of Indiana Food Festival. It's coming up in about a week and a half. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Chef Tom England, who is one of Dig-In's founders, Ted Grain. He's a member of the Indy Food Council Advisory Board and is also with LISC, that's the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. We've gotten an email from a listener named Marcia, and again, if you want to join the conversation by email, just shoot us something at nolimits@wfyi.org. Marcia says, I live in the Glendale area, north of 71st and Keystone, and wish we had some fun, innovative local restaurants in the area. I know there's a lot going on in Broad Ripple and Sobro, but not here. Any reason to hope? Thanks, Marcia.
Yeah, so I have loved the expansion of local food restaurants across the city. 71st and Keystone is nice because it is an easy drive to Broad Ripple and Sobro. But even at Keystone on the Crossing, one of my favorite restaurants in the city by far is Late Harvest Kitchen, which is right there at 82nd and Dean area.
Yeah.
So there's a whole dead zone, but it's a short dead zone before you either get to Keystone or Broad Ripple for sure.
Ted, what accounts for, there been any study, we've talked about how there is this, what did Tom refer to it as the fermentation corridor or sector or whatever, but it sounds like there's been a growth in some places of the city of really local and locally defined places where you can have a special and specific either dining or drinking experience. Do we know why those occur in certain places and not in others?
I think it, for me, it actually comes down to the neighborhood organizations and the neighborhood, the organized community and what they want in their own neighborhood and what they want in their place. So it first comes down to, do you have a neighborhood association that cares? Do you have a community development corporation that is active? And then do you have a vision for your place that involves a local flavor? So I think in the places that I've seen it arise in the city, so let's take Fountain Square, Broad Ripple, Irvington, those are all places that actually LISC had a early investor role in making some of that happen. We had a program called FOCUS, Fostering Commercial Urban Strategies, which is dedicated towards commercial revitalization of these urban corridors. And I think some of that happened in part because we were there and were able to provide early investor dollars. So, for example, Bluebeard and Milk Tooth and most of the restaurants and businesses in Fountain Square or even in Mass Ave at some point or another have experienced some investment from LISC in the terms of a facade grant or other small business support. But beyond LISC, I think it's probably because those places and those people in those places have wanted that special restaurant. And so I think it's really about demanding it and then going after it. And then finally, I think the building stock and the actual places themselves are unique and distinct enough, and they're starting to attract those types of restaurants and those types of entrepreneurs. So, for example, the Circle City Industrial Complex, this is a industrial building, 170,000 square feet. There's a lot of opportunity to have a lot of different things in there. And there's some production of food. So I mentioned Mile Square Coffee and New Day Meadery. But there's now going to be some restaurants and a brewery that will – and it's serving the community of the Cottage Home neighborhood. So I think it all is a package deal. I think it comes together with an organized community and a vision for that neighborhood.
You mentioned that often these places – I'm going to anticipate Marcia's next question too, which would be, okay, how do we get that kind of involvement in our neighborhood? What size are, say, those grants or the investment by LISC, and how do people who might be interested in making use of them to get something started, how do they go about applying or getting that support?
So there's a variety of support for small businesses in general, and often that is food-related businesses. You can go to our website, LISCIndianapolis.org, and find a listing of some of that support. The facade grant program is actually available citywide, so anyone in the county could apply for that. And there's a process and a committee that designates where those dollars go. It's a matching grant, one-to-one match. The business owner has to contribute 50% of that. And it's really designed to improve a commercial corridor so that the whole corridor improves at the same time. So it's a strategy. It's a support for the small business, but it's also a support for a specific place. Like currently we're really active in the Maple Crossing area. This is the area that's 38th and Illinois, right there, mm-hmm. Meridian and 38th and Illinois. It's a neighborhood called Maple Crossing.
Another, where the park is being developed just up
exactly.
the street.
Exactly. So yeah. Where Tarkington Park has been a lot of investment in Tarkington Park just north of there. So that's an area that we're currently looking at a few facade grants. But really it's a citywide program. And then in terms of small business support, we have different small business support loans that we could deploy. And not just us. There are other partners in the city like the Indy Chamber with the Business Ownership Initiative, BOI, the Small Business Development Corporation. All of those have different potential avenues of support.
Kimberly and Tom, I'm going to throw this question to both of you. Tom's mentioned a couple of times how, you know, in some ways, if not the initiative, at least part of the spark for the local food movement did start with the craft beers and all of that. And that's my perception. Long before I thought about, okay, I want locally grown food, when I would, in my days when I was still a traveling journalist, and I'd be someplace new, to have a drink either with colleagues or whatever, my first question would be, you know, what local beers do you have here? What do you recommend? Why do you think it started with beverages as opposed to food? I'll just frame it that way, and whether that perception is in fact true.
Well,
you're both looking at each other. Well, I need someone to answer.
No, I will say that, you know, I probably shouldn't say this, but us in the wine industry, we're incredibly jealous of beer.
Yeah.
Because it did get that sort of recognition, and it became, you know.
But it did translate. Like,
It does.
I don't drink a whole – I'm diabetic, so I don't get to drink a whole lot of beer these days. But I do drink an awful lot of red wine, and inevitably when I travel, I will ask, okay, what's a good local dry red wine?
No, thank you for that.
Yeah,
you know, we see the bumper stickers and everything that say, you know, think globally and drink locally. And that's something that really resonates with people. And so, you know, we just have to be in the business of converting those to eating local food too. And I think the breweries and some of the wineries have done a really good job of offering foods as well in the restaurants or that they're running or in the gift shops. That really make people think about that connection as well. So, you know, it's just you continue that thought pattern of, you know, if you're doing one thing locally, you know, this is the natural next step.
It's all about becoming an experience. And I think that's really what beer tapped into early was it became an experience. I wanted to talk about the kinds of beers I'm drinking. I want to talk about where it came from. And I think now, you know, wine kind of followed with that. And, you know, and food as well, that we talk about, you know, what is going into our bodies and really, you know, is it moral? Is it, you know, is it anything?
Well, and it seems to me there's also been a huge educational curve here, mm-hmm. too, in that I'll stick with you, Kimberly. I mean, the perception 40 years ago would have been if you really knew the difference between a Cabernet and a Merlot, you were a bit of a snob. Now that is not the case anymore. It's just something that people understand.
And I think that's still something we're fighting, is that, you know, there's certain, you know, and food's probably a little bit similar, is that there are certain wines and there are certain foods that you should be eating. Mm-hmm. And types like Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay. And I think that's a little bit of what we're fighting, whereas beer didn't necessarily have that. It was you drink what you like, and no mm-hmm. one's going to, you know, be a snob for that.
Yeah.
So whereas
beer
now
is the drink of the proletariat.
Exactly. So wine, and that's one of the things that we fight every day, is that drink the wine you like. You go to a restaurant, order the wine you like, and that's what Dig In, you know, is designed to do, is to find that wine you like. Same thing yeah. with restaurants. I think some restaurants in the past 20 years or 20 years ago are very intimidating, and nowadays they're a lot more approachable.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do, is demystify some of this stuff and make you think, oh, I can do this, or, you know, this isn't, you know, something that is at that class that I'm not at yet, mm-hmm. Type of thing. So, you know, we try to make
it. Yeah, I need to study to go out to dinner.
Yeah, exactly. We try to make it accessible. But yeah, I've been at those restaurants where, as a chef who's been in the business for over 20 years, I'll look at a menu and think, I don't know what that ingredient is that they have listed there even. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, you know, we've gotten away from that and are just eating good local food nowadays.
Well, let me, real quickly, since we're talking about this, I'm going to start with Ted on this one. What's the part of the food festival that you look forward to the most?
I think it's the diversity of the offerings. So I don't think, even if you're a confirmed foodie and you visit a different restaurant every week of the year, you're still not going to be able to actually see in one place all the different diversity of offerings that Dig In has. So that would be my...
Kimberly.
It's funny what he was talking about. I think it was 3 years ago at Dig In that I discovered that I like duck. And really that's what I'm excited about is, and I think every year we were talking about vegan and vegetarian options. My favorite dish is usually vegetarian or vegan. And so I've now started ordering to reflect that. So it's just discovering something new.
Yeah.
Is this like a busman's holiday for you, Tom, or is it?
You know, you say my favorite, or yeah. If I was to answer my favorite thing, yeah. It's 4 o'clock when it's done.
Yeah.
But yes, no, it is great for chefs in general around the city to come, and the camaraderie that happens around the chef community. Even if they're not participating as vendors at the festival, people come anyway because they want to be there with all the other chefs and all their friends. So it's become a trade organization type event where people learn from each other. And it's one of the few times chefs get together once a year and really share what they're doing.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Martha. And again, if you want to find us on Twitter, you can track us down at WFYI. Martha says, love your guests and Cottage Home, but CCIC is in Windsor Park neighborhood, she said.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Sure.
Okay. And again, we are talking about Dig In, the Taste of Indiana Food Festival. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ian has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ian, welcome to the program. Ian? All right, we'll see if we can get Ian back here in a bit. So, again, walk me through real quickly, because I'm sure we have made everyone hungry and thirsty in this past 50 minutes or so talking about all of this stuff. If people want to go to Dig In, where do they go?
Sure. The best place to go is digindiana.org. So it's digindiana.org. Just click on the festival link there, and you'll be able to buy tickets right there. Tickets range from $40 for general admission, and that's for the 12 to 4 time period to go around and taste all the different restaurants, breweries, and wineries. And then you could also do an early entry, which gets you in at 11 o'clock, and you get an hour jump on everybody else so you can get into a few more places. Or you can get a VIP, which actually gets you into a special designated area as well that has some of the restaurants that are – you know, the ones that are getting the awards and the restaurants that may not be big enough to be able to do 5,000 samples of stuff. So that's a good place to get in. And again, those VIPs get in at 11 o'clock so they can get some of the general admission stuff first before they go back in the VIP area.
I think we've got Ian back right now, so we're going to give that a try. Ian, welcome to the program.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yes, thank you.
Sorry, I guess I got dropped. Well, my name's Ian Mott, and I own a local farm, Super Microgreens, and I wanted to respond to your question about why beer over produce first.
Mm-hmm.
And from our perspective, it definitely seems like an education thing. People just are used to the food that they're used to, and so we're doing a lot of outreach with local schools and the community to try and get chefs as well as individuals to use local products.
And how is that going?
It's going fairly well. We've got a lot of buy-in from the local community schools and the city, the mayor's office. We've been really pleased with the level of interest, and everyone seems to be excited.
Well, thanks very much for the call and for sharing your comments or questions.
Yeah, and
Thank you so much for your time.
Certainly. I think he has a really good point. I mean, we talk about it with coffee all the time. We know where the coffee bean was grown, if it was grown in the shade or in the sunlight. We know, you know, how it was roasted. We know this incredible detail, even the elevation that it was grown at. But nobody cares where their broccoli comes from. And yet we're ingesting a lot more of that broccoli than we are the infusion of that coffee. So we just need to think about where our food comes from more as a society than we do now.
And I want to ask a larger question here. We have very little time for, but I also wanted to get this important information. How many tickets have been sold so far? Since you cap it at 5,000, how quickly do people have to move?
We're on a pace to sell out by next Friday.
Okay.
With a VIP, we'll probably sell out over the weekend. So, yeah, now's the time. Don't waste time.
And I was going to say, you know, in some ways it sounds like a no-brainer to start consuming more locally in foods and beverages. But we've got this gap. What's the obstacle to getting people to see this? I mean, what's the thing that needs to be educated? Ted, I'm going to give you about 15 seconds on that, sadly.
I don't know that it's people needing to get educated. Obviously, people should, if they want to, help increase the demand for that kind of product by choosing to do so with their personal lives. But I think there's some systemic issues in our local food production system, such as access to capital for small producers. There's a barrier there that we need to address as a state, really as a system, to support small producers at the local level.
Is there a reason, though, that more people don't say, Tom, that they want to consume locally?
I just think people don't know that they need to make that choice. Indiana Locally Grown has done a really good job of working with places like Marsh and Meijer and Kroger in getting kiosks set up so that people can see, oh, yeah, this is made in the state of Indiana and this is where I can find these things. So, you know, I think that access has been a lot more easier this year than it ever has been before. And so people are starting to make that decision more often.
Well, one more time, the URL if people want to order the tickets since they are going fast.
Yes. Yeah, go online to digindiana.org and purchase those tickets right away.
That's going to have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Chef Tom England, who's one of Dig In's founders, Ted Grain, who's a member of the Indy Food Council Advisory Board, who's also with LISC, that's the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and Kimberly Utterback of Easley Winery. Also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments. We will be back on Tuesday when we're going to be talking with Ken Beckley about his new novel, An Act of Frustration. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.